I think I'll do a similar format I did last night. I'll talk a little bit first, and then we can do some meditation, and then maybe a bit of a Dhamma talk afterwards. One of the things I was just kind of struck me when I was just kind of walking in here, one of the people in the interviews today mentioned that they had been helped a lot in the recent times by listening to the talks of Ajahn Brahm. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Ajahn Brahm, right? Yeah, I think most of you. Has he been here? He has been here. That's right, of course he's been here. When did he come?
2 or 3 years ago.
2 or 3 years ago, a long time ago now. When they said that, I sort of was reflecting. I was kind of quite moved by that, because I was just reflecting all of the things. Because I'm sure many of you kind of know him, you know, oh, Ajahn Brahm, he's that kind of funny English monk who tells really bad jokes, and that's kind of all you know. But I just kind of really was really kind of moved by this kind of feeling of gratitude for my teacher when I was thinking about him before. I was thinking about so many of the things that he's done in his life, which are shaping all of the things that we do right now. And I mean, just a sort of a partial list. He was the first of all of the monks in the Western Sangha. He was the first one to really study the monastic code, and to really kind of make a distinction between what we practice as just what we kind of see around us. So in our those days we were in Thailand in the monastery, and what was being done in that Ajahn Chah tradition, and then what the Vinaya says, and to say, well, it's not always the same, right? And this is really kind of foundational, I think, for us today as monastics. You know, we're very aware of this distinction. It's really fundamental for us, and it really helps to do many things. In particular, it helps us to be able to see and relate to those who are practicing from different traditions, because we can often identify that there are so many things we do in common, that even though things might look different on the surface, there's so many common things. He was the first of the Western Sangha, basically, who started really studying the suttas and putting them into practice. Again, it sounds like a strange thing, but before that time, nobody actually in the English-speaking Sangha was really studying suttas. There was some in Sri Lanka that was a bit different, but in the Thai forest tradition, nobody was really doing that. And there was kind of a split between like the people who were studying and the people who were practicing. And he was one of the first. Again, he's not the first person to do this, obviously. I mean, in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa was one of the great innovators in that area. But he was the first in sort of that kind of movement who started really doing that, and who really kind of started illuminating a lot of the ideas from the suttas and about meditation. He was one of the first Western teachers to start talking about jhanas, and this is in the mid-90s when very few people were doing that. In fact, he was inspired to do that by Ayakema, who visited Bodhinyana Monastery, and she gave a talk about jhanas, and it was after that that he started talking about it. He began, I think, in probably the late 80s, or even perhaps the late 80s, using non-gendered language in his writings. And he was the first monk that I know who did that. He was also probably the first one who really started to emphasize the point of the emotional connection that we have with our meditation and with the breath. And a lot of the times up until then, that sort of meditation was kind of a bit clinical. The way that meditation was taught was a bit clinical. But he always had this kind of really big heart. And I'm just sort of saying this to you now as something, you know, for myself, as kind of a homage to my teacher and gratitude for the fact that I've, you know, been able to train with him and to learn from him, however little. And, you know, even if you go back to the early days in his monastery in Thailand, you hear kind of stories, like when he was at Wat Nanachat, when I met a fellow in Sydney a number of years ago who had previously been a monk in Thailand at the same monastery. And so when Ajahn Brahm was there and all the other monks were there, and he'd come and he just briefly ordained, just recently ordained, name's Vince. And just remember this because I got an email from him just the other day. And he told me that when he was just a young monk in Thailand, they were having one of their days where they had a an evening meditation in the hall, and all the kind of the monks were out there in the hall, and he was in his hut for some reason, and there was a storm that night, a very bad storm, and a tree fell on his hut and knocked it down. He sort of got out of there, but he was all kind of wet and shaken, and came into the main hall, you know, drowned and wet, and just looked kind of ridiculous, right? There's a kind of formal sitting going on, and this kind of wet monk comes in the middle, and all of the other monks laughed. And Ajahn Brahm immediately jumped off the seat and came and gave him his robe and wrapped him up in his robe and kept him warm. And that's the kind of thing that stays with you forever. Yeah? And, you know, knowing Ajahn Brahm and knowing who he is and being with him, you know, that's exactly who he is, like, all the time. If you, I just remember so many kind of moments. Like if you're with a group of monks, and we drive into town, and to do something, and you'd stop by the post office to drop the mail off on the way, right? I mean, it was really hard to beat Ajahn Brahm to grab the letters and drop them in the mailbox, right? Even though he's the senior monk, he's the Ajahn, right? He's supposed to be the one we're looking after him. But he would always be the quickest one to grab the mail and put it in the mailbox. So all these kinds of things that you see, it's just that, to me, is that quality of character. Of course, you know, he also was a leader in helping to support the Bhikkhuni order, and not to steal the thunder at all. I mean, the ones who are really brave and have really gone out there and done the work are the Bhikkhunis themselves. And those who've supported them, and that's really the hard work. But he was there, even though he had to go against his tradition, and he was there because he knew it was the right thing to do. And he wasn't just supporting them in name, but he's spent now several years of his life basically doing fundraising to support Bhikkhuni monasteries. And, you know, he's putting it all down on the line. He's also been very supportive of the LGBT community for a long time, and he's one of the ones who's been leading in that. And both he, myself, Ajahn Brahmali, we've all been speaking in support of the LGBTQ communities throughout Asia, in places like Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, for many years now. And this is this doesn't happen, right? It doesn't happen. And, you know, several times anyway. And so he's giving me so much courage to be able to find my own path in the Dhamma, and to be somebody who's not afraid to stick up for what he believes in, and to be somebody who you can disagree with. And, you know, here I am, you know, I'm feeling quite emotional at the moment, I don't know why, but just thinking about all of these things that I've got from my teacher. But I know that if we were to sit and talk about something, I would be extremely happy to say to him, no, I don't agree with that, and have an argument about something, and it would be fine. It's fine, right? We do it all the time. So these things that are happening here, you know, even if I look here and I can think so many of the things about what you guys are doing. I mean, you're not Ajahn Brahm's students, you know, probably only just met him a brief time, but so much about what you can do here is actually made possible by so many of the things that he's done. Again, not to, you know, it's not just him. Obviously, there's all this community and so on who's done that. He actually told a joke about that. He won some award in WA one time, and then when he won the award, he went up and gave a speech and said, well, it wasn't because of me, it was because of everybody else who was helping me, and so on and so forth. Then the next year he went to the same award, and the person who won the award that year got up and said, well, it wasn't me, it was because of my community and my friends and everybody who's helping me. Then he realized, no, that's wrong. I should say, yes, it was me. I was the one who did it. I deserve this award. And he recently got awarded, what is it, an Order of Australia medal or something like this. I mean, I hate these awards and things like that. But anyway, they gave it to Ajahn Brahm, so that's good. And he said the only reason he accepted it was because of the reason that it gave for it was his support for gender equality. So all of the things that we have here and the things that have been made possible for you on this retreat comes from somewhere. It's not isolated. It's not just kind of one-off. Yeah? And whatever, you know, wisdom I've been able to share with you is wisdom that I've learnt from my teachers. In some cases I say things that I haven't learnt from my teachers, from my own wisdom. But the fact that I have the courage to say that is also something that I've learnt from my teachers. So, I don't know whether this is going to help you at all, or it's just something that I wanted to share with you, but just to sort of, I don't know, I just felt like saying that. Now, we've been here on this retreat for a few days together. You have been a very beautiful and very wonderful sangha, a very wonderful community to be with, and I know it's not easy to share this space together, and in a way it's a kind of metaphor for the earth, right? Too many people and not enough space. So we're going to have to learn to get along together somehow. We have this path of Dhamma that we're attracted to because we feel the need to find peace, the need to find joy. And yet, somehow, along the way, we kind of bump into all of these other weirdos who are kind of walking along the same path, right? And it's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, I wish... You know, leave me alone so I can get on with my meditation. Turns out, though, that somewhere along the way, those weirdos become kind of important and actually really essential to your path. And this is something which the Buddha talked about many times, and there's very beautiful verses in the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta where the Buddha said that it's such a blessing to find a good friend, a wise companion who you can practice together with. If you can't find a good friend, then okay, then you go off and wander alone. Yeah, sometimes you have to do that. In my life, I have contact with a lot of people, the Dhamma practitioners right across the world, and I'm, you know, painfully aware of how many people don't have a good friend, don't have a companion. You know, people contact me, give me an email or something on the forum, and they ask this problem in the meditation. I'm like, dude, it's a meditation forum. I can't teach you about meditation here. You have to actually meditate together or sit in the same room together at least. But they don't have anybody, and they don't have a community, they don't have a teacher that they can ask. So this is something that I have always been so lucky to have in my life, is good teachers, good Dhamma companions. I haven't always appreciated them as much as I should have done. But the more I look back at it, the more you realize how much that's made all of this possible. And so the community that you have here, the Sangha who's staying here, the people who are sharing the retreat with you, and all of the broader community who's making it possible, these are your people, these are your family, your Dhamma family. And this little group of people is here now, and soon we won't be. It will be gone. I'll be going off to Europe. I'll be going and trying to avoid cracking Irish jokes in Dublin. And you all go your separate ways. Some of you will come and hang around the center a bit. Some of you maybe will disappear, maybe won't be seen again. But I would encourage you to try to keep some kind of contact, try to come back to the center, try to kind of maintain and develop the friendships. Don't think it's just nothing. And don't think it will just happen again. Right? It may well not do. Remember how, like I said, when you're in high school, right? You've got all these friends and you go separate ways. And you don't think about it. And then you turn around 10 years later, where have they gone? Now I don't have any friends. It's really sad. Yeah, it's really sad. So in the retreat so far, on the first day, I emphasized about the mindfulness of the body, the physical mindfulness. Second day, the metta. And the third day, I talked about impermanence. And I'm not teaching sort of a detailed vipassana method or anything like that. It's only a short retreat. I don't want to do too much. But just to have like a hint, just to have like a question in your mind about what this is and what this impermanence means. When we talk about the idea of impermanence, impermanence isn't a reductive idea. What that means is that you can't say, we can reduce impermanence to say, well, it kind of means this thing. Like sometimes they have this idea of what they call the moments. As you probably heard, it's like mind moments or something like that. It's like everything's impermanent because it's just mind moments that just last a fraction of a second. But that's really not what impermanence means. Impermanence means, yes, it happens on that momentary level, but it also happens on a level of seconds, on a level of minutes, of days, of lifetimes, of eons. All of these things are impermanent, and the impermanence of each one of those things is just as real. When we meditate, we're seeing the impermanence of what's going on in our mind, in our body, in the present. We're seeing the shifting patterns of things. And when we first see that, we see it as something that is more or less just a happenstance. You see a thought, the thought comes to an end. Oh, that's all. It's just a thought that comes to an end. You see a feeling, the feeling comes to an end. Oh, the feeling comes to an end. It doesn't really mean anything. And this is the difference between the idea of like seeing something and inferring something. And I mentioned this a little bit this morning. To a point that's widely misunderstood in Buddhist and Buddhist circles. People think that vipassana is about seeing things directly. But you can't see impermanence directly, because you can only see things that are actually present. If you see something present and then something's absent, what about what is the and then? Something's there and then it's not there. You can't see those two things at the same time. So you have to infer. So understanding impermanence is based on inference and memory. This is not a fault with it, right? This is how it works. Everything's impermanent. Sabbe sankhara anicca. What do we mean when we say everything's impermanent? Every conditioned thing is impermanent. So what are we supposed to do? Sort of make a list of every conditioned thing? That could take some time. Has anyone read the short story by Borges? Was it The Aleph? Anyone know that? One of the classic ones, right? And the Aleph was a point in reality where through which you could see all other points in reality. And somebody happened to stumble across it on the stairs down to his basement. And so he had this Aleph and he didn't quite know what to do with it. But the unfortunate thing, the tragedy of this, was that the fellow who stumbled across it was a poet. So he proceeded to start writing a poem that would describe everything that he saw through the Aleph. And the story had been, like, maybe 7 years previously or something like that, he had been working on this, and so far he had described several feet of a barbed wire fence at the back of a sheep station in Victoria in Australia. And he was hoping to move on from that sometime soon. So, if we're seeing all conditions are impermanent, don't we have to see everything is impermanent? Every star, every atom, every fence on a sheep station? What do we really mean when we talk about sabbe sankhara anicca? So obviously, no, we don't have to see all of those things. What we have to do is understand what is the nature of things, what is the nature of conditions. And when you understand the nature of conditions, then you let go. See, we see this thing. And then we see that thing. In our mind, there's a connection between the two things. This is an inference. And if we can connect two things, we can connect three things. And if we can connect three things, we can connect the whole world. Yeah? This is how insight works. And so the question then becomes, well, okay, I can see that this thing is impermanent. I can see that the thing changes. And when you can see that that thing changes, you can let go of it. Right? So how is it that I'm still holding on to things? Right? I mean, I've let go of that thing, but I'm still holding on to a bunch of other things. Right? I know that they're impermanent. Right? I know. But still, they're quite nice while they're here, right? So we still hold on to them. So we see, but we don't really see. We know, but we don't quite know. Now, the arising of knowing is a very curious thing. Think about it. If I say to you now, what's 3 plus 4? Now, I'm sure all of you have an answer in your mind. Hopefully, got it right. I've heard the stories about the American education system, but seriously, when I was in California, I spent some time with a fellow who teaches maths in the university, and at that time they were saying that 5% of they were talking about the wildfires. Was it 5% of the wildfires had been, 5% of the county was on fire or something like that? Was it 5% was on fire, something like that? And he said, you see, because he teaches at university level, and he said, you see, a lot of my students wouldn't understand that. They wouldn't understand what a percent is. I know, right? Yeah. So this is what he has to do, is teach people what percent means, teach university students. Anyway, where was I? All right, 3 plus 4. The answer is 7, just in case you're wondering. So when I say that, where does that answer come from? 3 plus 4, where does that come from? You know the answer. Well, it's memory. We kind of knew that. We learned that when we were kids. Is it memory? But that's just kind of a word that you use to explain away the experience. I mean, the reality is that it's not there, and then it's there. Right? That's how memory works. Something's not there, and then it's there. And that's how insight works, isn't it? When you don't understand something and the answer comes to you, it's not there, and then it's there. It's so weird. The way a mind works is so weird. It's like all the machinery happens on backstage, and then they just come out and present the answer to you. And you don't quite know where it comes from. I'm sure you're familiar with the sort of the Eureka effect, right? So it comes from, I think it was Archimedes who had to solve the problem of how to measure, what was his problem? Oh, that's right, there was a statue had been presented to somebody, and he had to figure, a golden statue, and he had to figure out, was the statue pure gold or was it mixed with lesser metals? And how do you figure that out? And then he couldn't work it out, so he says, well, I'll have a bath. And then he lies down in the bath and he sees the water level going up and he realizes, ah, that's how I can do it. I can see how much volume is displaced by the statue by measuring the amount of water, and then I can compare that to the weight of gold. So he shouts, Eureka, I found it, and runs down the street naked. So that's the story. And that kind of Eureka effect is actually very well documented, but I think largely unappreciated in the sciences and different kind of fields. That people say in physics, they have a kind of saying, it's the bed, the bus, and the bath. These are the three places where insights happen. Yeah, you don't come to insights when you're sitting in front of a chalkboard or sitting in front of your computer or something like that, or even like talking to somebody. The insights come when you relax, when you're not thinking about it. It's not to say that there's something wrong with thinking about it, because it wouldn't come if you hadn't thought about it, right? I mean, that's doing all the work. But the actual answer, the way the answer comes to you, is mysterious. And if you look at the different accounts for this, and it's not just in physics, but also in art and all kinds of things, you know, you constantly see this. If you look at the writings of how great creative people come up with their ideas, you know, it came to me in a dream. You know, it came to me when I was, smoking opium or whatever, something. And somehow this thing comes from somewhere that we don't understand. And the answer comes. And that's exactly the same process as the process of insight in the Dhamma. It's the same thing. It's the mind. It's just the mind. That's how the mind works. That's why samadhi is always the thing that comes before real insight. Because samadhi is the bed, the bus, and the bath. Right? It's the time when your mind is relaxed and peaceful and at ease, not trying to figure out the problem. But it's the bed, the bus, and the bath squared. To keep the mathematical simile going, right? That's the highest state, the deepest state of stillness and intuition and relaxation is in samadhi. It's far better than any of those other means. And so the knowledge that comes to you in those times is the knowledge that comes, it's just there. And those ideas that we have about impermanence, things change, right? We think we know that. We think we've seen it in meditation. We think we know. Working it out, applying ourselves, contemplating all of these things. And then when the mind's peaceful, then you finally see it. Ah, that's what it is. That's the process. That's why samadhi always comes before seeing things as they really are. That's how the mind works. So when you're doing like what they call a vipassana meditation, of like, you know, investigating impermanence and these kinds of things. These are doing things that are like sort of laying the groundwork, right? This is the spade work that will lead to insight later on, right? But you'll often find that it's not while doing that that the actual insights will come. It's sometime later. And there are many examples you can see like this in the suttas as well, especially in the Tara and Tarikata. People talk about how frustrated they are in meditation or something, and then they go away and suddenly just the answer comes to them. That's how the mind works. So all of this stuff that we're teaching, and the stuff that, you know, I learned from Ajahn Brahm and that is reinforced by my understanding in the suttas, this is the psychology of it. This is why we teach that stuff. This is why we say to you when you come on retreat, you know, don't push yourself too hard. Take it easy, be relaxed, because it's in that relaxed state of mind that you will have your real insights. If you're always pushing yourself, and if your meditation is always programmed by some method and some idea, then you'll always be stuck within that method and idea. and you will never have a real insight. And I've seen so many people who are meditators who've been doing it for so many years, and they honestly, they don't have any insight. Frankly, they just sound like a textbook. And they keep on reiterating the same bog-standard answers to questions that you could have read in a textbook from 100 years ago. And they're not seeing the reality. It's just stale. Everything's, it's like stale insight and stale wisdom. So this is the role of that path of meditation that we're teaching here. The role of joy, the role of peace, is to bring your mind to that state where it is so very, very still. And when the mind is so very, very still, then the truth will arise. Okay, so let's do some guided meditation. Would you like to do another metta meditation this evening? Or would you like to do it? Yes? Yeah? Anyone else? Or would you like to do another kind of meditation? What would you like to do?
Four elements.
Four elements? Okay. So you're going to say?
Something new.
Something new? Something borrowed, something blue. Okay. Okay, four elements. So we'll do a meditation on the four elements, and we'll do one approach to it. As with all of these meditations, there are many approaches, but this is one approach to it. Thank you. as we sit quietly, and give yourself a few minutes to settle back into your body and to let the energies and the tensions in the body settle down. In this meditation, we'll contemplate each of the four main elements in turn. Begin with the earth element. And to start with, we'll pay attention to the most obvious expression of the earth element inside your own body. So the earth element is the element of hardness and solidity. The easiest way to begin is by being aware of the teeth inside your mouth. Just gently touch the teeth with your tongue, explore what they feel like. And just feel what they're like sitting there in your jaw, the hardness of them. And when we're doing this meditation, we can experience these elements both as something which is touched and also something which is seen. So this is partly happening in our imagination, partly happening in our felt experience. But the main point is to get an idea of what that hardness is like inside your body. the different parts of the body. So you can feel that feeling of hardness through your bones, your spine, nails, anywhere inside your body. That has that hard feeling of resistance. Is clear. Take it outside of your body, first to the obvious things, the hardness of the seat that you're sitting on. Notice that that earth element, that hardness of your seat, is just the same as the earth element inside your body. It's the same quality, the same. The same property. You can feel it in your body in one way, and you can feel it outside of your body in another way. Your seat is connected to the floor to this building. And this whole building is constructed and kept up by that hardness and rigidity of the earth element. You can take your mind out further to the whole earth and just feel this world, this planet that we're on. You feel the ground underneath us stretching out thousands of miles in this huge sphere. And the earth element that's inside us. It's the same as the earth element outside, the same as the earth element in every other person, every other animal, every other plant. And all this is impermanent. In the past, the earth element in your body was all in the ground. That's how it was not long ago. And in a little while, it'll be back in the ground. And all of the things that we think are so important, the trees, the cities, the roads, even the mountains and the deserts and the forests, all of these things, it's just the earth element. One day, they too will be gone. Turn our attention to the water element. And similarly, we begin by paying attention to the most obvious example of the water element. Usually that's the saliva inside your mouth. And just feel the wetness of that. Feel the quality of that. It's quite different from the quality of earth and hardness. There's a distinct experience that we associate with that property of water or wetness. So when you've got an idea what that is like, then see if you can see any other examples of the water element inside your body. Maybe in your eyes, you can feel the tears in your eyes. Less clearly, you can feel the water in the other parts of your body. We know that our body is made up mostly of water. And the softness and the wetness of the body comes from that. Same way, take the mind outside of the body. See if you can feel any wetness that's outside. Again, start with what's close to your body. You can feel maybe a little bit of moisture or sweat on your skin, maybe somewhere. And recognize that just because that moisture is not inside your body anymore, still has the same quality as the water that's inside your body. And water from the outside comes into our body, from the in the body goes out. It's not a fixed thing, it's a process, it's a flow. And then think of all the water further out in the bodies of everybody else sitting here. The water in the pipes, in the various jugs of drink or food in the fridge. The liquids that are in the cars, the petrol. And then not very far away from us is the great ocean. water in the ocean is basically the same as the water that's flowing through our veins. And all the water inside of us, at one point or another, has been in the ocean. There's also the water under the ground, water in the sky. And we're part of this flowing network of water. If you have the good luck to fly in a plane over the desert after it's rained, you can look down and you can see the water flowing through the sands in the desert and the tracks it makes. And it looks exactly the same as the veins inside your body. So all of this water also is impermanent. One day this body will pass away, be dried out, become a husk, disintegrate. And even the great ocean, that sometimes the ocean rises up, swallows the land in flood. In other times it recedes, vanishes, and there'll come a time when this whole planet is completely devoid of water. Now come to the fire element. And you can feel inside your body again and notice any feeling of hot or cold. So when we feel a temperature of heat, we can say that there is a strong fire element there. If there's a feeling of cold, we say the fire element is weak. So notice those different feelings. They have a certain particular tone to them, a certain kind of experience. The experience of heat or cold is quite different than the experience of hardness or the experience of wetness. It's a different kind of physical property. But just like the other ones, you can see it in your own experience inside your body. sometimes that experience will change during your meditation. You might heat up or cool down. Sometimes you experience the feelings as pleasant or unpleasant. Taking the awareness outside your body, feel the touch of air on your skin, or any feeling of the warm or cool that comes, and you see how that external temperature affects what's going on inside, and vice versa. It's moving backwards and forwards, in and out of the body. And this heat is this energy you can experience in here, you can also experience out there. And the room we're in now is somewhat warm. There are heaters, warm bodies in here. And just outside those walls, it's freezing cold. Expand your awareness. Think about all of the other houses in this neighborhood. And think of all the houses around here just the same. Inside they're heated. Those who can afford heating. And then outside is cold. we shift the heat element around for our own comfort. And then right across the world, right across the planet. The freezing cold in the poles, or on the Himalayas, and the searing heat in the deserts, the fires, the bushfires in Australia or California. The heat of a coal furnace smelting steel, the heat of a nuclear reactor or a car engine, and just a little bit above this ground where we are, just a few miles up, is the absolute freezing of space. And this universe, this galaxy that we live in, almost all of it, is just a fraction above absolute zero. And we live in this tiny, tiny little zone. Coming to the air element, and as always, starting with the most obvious examples of the air element inside your body, and usually that's the breath. You can feel the movement of the breath through your nostrils and your lungs. And that kind of pressure and movement, again, has a quite different kind of quality than the earth, different quality than the water, different quality than the heat. And when we talk about the air element, it's actually very close in meaning, really, to the wind element. So the idea of movement is very prominent. And inside your body you may have other air moving around apart from your breath, gas in your intestines or something. But also we think of the energies moving in your limbs as being a kind of air element as well. So all those kinds of moving and shifting fields and energies. taking that awareness of the air element outside your body, again beginning close to the body, feeling that breath as it goes out and breath as it comes in. Always that interface, always that movement from the in to the out, from the out to the in. Breaking down the boundaries and the barriers of what we consider to be ourselves. And the air that's inside our lungs becomes part of what's in the air around us. Each of the people in this room, sitting here breathing, we've all breathed in each other's air by now. A part of you is inside me, and a part of me is inside you. Outside of this room, and then the air element is blowing across the earth, holding up that plane we can hear. Fanning the flames in the bushfires. Blowing up the dust in the deserts. Whipping up the waves on the ocean. And the same air, the same atmosphere that you and I are breathing is being breathed by a little girl in a slum in Mumbai. It's being breathed by a man who's going to prayer in Iran. It's being breathed by a secretary going to work in Berlin. This air element too is impermanent. Our own bodies one day will breathe the last. We don't know when that will be. It could be this very breath. And then our body will lie down, abandoned, devoid of consciousness. And this air element across the planet also is impermanent. Sometimes the air gets stirred up into mighty storms raging across the globe. Sometimes it becomes so still that nothing's moving anywhere. And sooner or later, after a very long time, all of the air in this planet will be lost. So now we come back, being awareness and ground awareness inside our own body. And remind yourself of the earth element, the water element, the heat element, the air element, all of them working together in your body in balance and harmony, keeping you alive and sustaining you right now. And that balance is so delicate and so precious, so easy to upset. As we're coming to the end of the meditation, just remember, remind yourself once more of how these elements that we have, nothing more than the same elements borrowed from our planet, shared with the environment, the ecosystem around us. They don't belong to us. We don't own them. We don't have any rights to them. We should have gratitude for them. And before we finish, take a minute to review over the meditation we've done together. I want you to just cast your mind back over the different stages of the meditation. The experience of the elements, which ones were easy to experience, which ones were less easy. What things were clear, what things were unclear. What kind of response did your mind have to the different stages of meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.